It is a State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A challenge to Wisconsin's abortion ban could already be making its way to the state Supreme Court. The law was first passed in 1849 and went back into effect last June when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. In our series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849, WPR reporters explore how the ban came to be and how Wisconsinites have lived with and without it since. In part one, WPR's Brady Carlson sat down with Bridget Bowden and Evan Casey to talk about the earliest part of the history.
Just over a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states could regulate abortion as they saw fit, the way they had done before the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. Wisconsin law has banned nearly all abortions for a long time.
1849.
The 1849 ban.
That 1849 ban on abortion.
The 1849 law.
1849.
The Supreme Court's decision put that 19th century state law back into effect. Since then, we've heard a lot about the effects of that law, how it's brought legal abortion in Wisconsin to a halt, and how it's played a big role in the last few elections. We've also heard a lot about efforts to challenge the Wisconsin abortion law in court. What we haven't heard much about is the 1849 law itself and how it first came to be. Here to tell us more about that is WPR's Bridget Bowden and Evan Casey. This law is almost as old as the state of Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah, so just 1 year after Wisconsin became a state, abortion was banned. And a version of that ban actually stayed on the books for the last 174 years or so. So when Roe v. Wade was overturned, it went back into effect.
Bridget, what did abortion look like in Wisconsin in the 1840s?
Yeah, so we know that abortion was happening at this time. Abortions were being done by so-called abortionists or by doctors, and also just at home by regular people. Home medical journals sometimes had instructions for ending a pregnancy or what they would call restoring the menzies. Here's what UW Green Bay history professor Kimberly Riley told us about it.
So people would use combinations of, you know, tansy or rue or quinine or even castor oil. And in the right combination and at the right strength, there are these sort of herbal remedies that can induce contractions that can bring on effectively like a miscarriage.
And Riley said it wasn't always spelled out in clear language, like this will end your pregnancy. It was more of a wink, wink.
It remedies the most serious form of female complaint. It is it allows you to expel in an early stage a tumor from the womb. And so everybody would know what you meant by, well, you know, what was meant by tumor.
And keep in mind that a woman who became pregnant at this time couldn't get a pregnancy test. You know, there was no way to prove that the reason she wasn't getting her period was because she was pregnant until she started to feel fetal movements or baby kicks. And that was known as quickening. And it's a really important part of this history.
How so?
So quickening, or those baby kicks, are something that pregnant women usually begin to feel in the second trimester. And actually, when Wisconsin first banned abortion in 1849, it was only illegal after quickening.
The original law made the willful killing of what was called an unborn quick child manslaughter in the first degree. So under that original ban, abortion was actually legal in the first few months of pregnancy. And historian Kimberly Riley says this is really notable, especially now post-Roe.
I was immediately struck by the irony, the deep irony, that in 1849, you know, people who were pregnant had more rights to terminate a pregnancy than they do today.
What was the public attitude about abortion at the time? Was this a hot button issue in the 1840s like it is today?
Actually, no, it wasn't. Historians say that it's actually hard to fathom the attitude towards the issue at the time because it is so different than what it is today. Historian James Moore wrote the book Abortion in America, which chronicles abortion history in the 19th century. And he says because early pregnancy was so different than what it is today, the attitude towards abortion in general may have also been different.
19th century people probably thought of contraception as going right through quickening. That is, it was almost a form of birth control to that point.
He also says that this movement to make those laws wasn't a moral movement and it wasn't a religious movement, the way that many people think of it today.
It's almost impossible impossible for Americans today to think of abortion as an issue that was not tied to religion. But in the 19th century, it was not tied very closely anyway to religion. That is, it was a medical question. It was not a religious or a moral question.
So if it's not a moral or a religious question in this time, why was abortion banned in 1849?
So Moore says it was part of a national movement to professionalize medicine that was happening at the time. The American Medical Association was new, and they wanted a crackdown on other people performing abortions. So this is when you start to see a lot of anti-abortion laws popping up across the nation.
These were not public campaigns. They were campaigns conducted by elite physicians who had the ear of legislatures and were able to suggest that this was necessary legislation.
And other states around the country, including Michigan, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, and Massachusetts, were also passing similar abortion laws around this time. Today, a lot of lawmakers rely on something called model legislation, and that's kind of what was happening in this case. Wisconsin appeared to be borrowing from other states that were passing abortion restrictions at this same time.
And is the 1849 law what's in place now in Wisconsin?
Actually, no, not quite. In 1858, the word quick was removed from the ban, and abortion became illegal at any time in pregnancy. And that's the version of the ban that we have now.
All right. What prompted that change in 1858?
So this is where we want to introduce you to a guy named William Henry Brisbane, who's a really key figure in this part of the history. He was a pastor and a physician who was born in South Carolina and eventually settled in Orena, Wisconsin. Brisbane was an abolitionist, and he was also opposed to abortion. He served as the clerk of the state Senate, which is like a secretary. They helped with drafting legislation and making suggestions to lawmakers.
And Bridget and I went and looked at his writings in the archives of the State Historical Society, and we didn't find anything about abortion. UW-Madison doctoral student Bridget Nannenhorn, who was researching the state's abortion history, says she couldn't find him discussing abortion either.
In his diaries, he talks about anti-slavery, he talks about temperance, he talks about gambling. He does not mention abortion. He does not mention miscarriage, infanticide, any word that, you know, would think, okay, here he's talking about it.
We do know that he was corresponding with a national leader in the anti-abortion movement at the time. So we know from these letters that Brisbane claims the credit for taking the word quick out of the law and turning it into the abortion ban that we have today.
But why he wanted to do that appears to still be an open question.
Yeah, so his motivation isn't super clear. On the one hand, he was a pastor and a very religious person. But on the other hand, as far as we know, he actually never wrote about religion being a motivating factor here. What we do know about the national movement at this time is that historians say activists are talking about abortion becoming more commonplace, especially among middle-class white women. They had concerns about poorer, non-white women driving population growth.
So the one thing that's the same today is the letter of the state law from the mid-19th century, but what's around that law is very different.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Bridget and Evan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And for more than 100 years, abortion was illegal in Wisconsin, but it continued through folk practices and underground networks of physicians. Join us tomorrow morning at 7 for part 2 of this series as we learn what the abortion landscape was like in Wisconsin after 1849. See more of the WPR series, How We Got Here, at WPR.org. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican state lawmakers seek to block government agencies from closing churches and houses of worship during emergencies. It's legislation that failed in the past, and their path forward this time is through a constitutional amendment, which we'll explore. And you can call in with your question or comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anya Van Wagtendonk is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. Anya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So to what extent would Senate Joint Resolution 54 exempt churches from government-imposed restrictions?
Yeah, this proposal would add a line to the religious freedom section of the Wisconsin State Constitution. That's a section that says that the government can't stop a person from worshiping how they choose and can't make a person worship in a particular way or give preference to a particular religion. So this new addition would also say that the government can't close places of worship or forbid gatherings in places of worship during a state of emergency that includes public health emergencies like a pandemic, but that could also be other times of crisis like severe weather or political unrest.
So COVID-19 here, kind of the undergirding, what happened during COVID that would perhaps, you know, attach itself to this constitutional amendment?
Yeah, that's right. So during the first couple of months of the COVID-19 pandemic here in Wisconsin, there was a limit on gatherings of more than 10 people. So, of course, that could also affect in-person worship services, particularly, you know, on major holidays, but also just kind of on a regular basis. One thing that's kind of interesting, so it didn't single out churches or religious services, but they were affected. And one kind of point that's been raised is how closure would be defined and how gathering would be defined in such a prohibition. So if, you know, buildings are ordered to close, but a church service can be held virtually, does that mean that the worship gathering has or has not been interrupted by such an order?
So have you heard of religious leaders responding to this proposed constitutional amendment?
Yeah, there was a public hearing on the proposal last month. There was some testimony sort of for, nothing specifically against, but some religious groups came out just with some questions, you know, neither for nor against. So the Wisconsin Council of Churches raised that question about, again, how do we define closure? How do we define gathering? And how do we also protect a religious institution's commitment to maintaining, for example, the health of its congregation? So it raised some nuances to that. There has been, again, when I've spoken to the lawmakers who proposed this amendment, they say that they've spoken with religious leaders who are very much in support of this proposed amendment.
Can you put a finer point on this? Did Governor Tony Evers ban churches from operating during the pandemic?
No, churches would have just been included, or houses of worship would have just been included in that ban on gatherings of more than 10 people. So in the same way that schools and businesses were affected, houses of worship were also affected by that limit on gatherings.
Why do Republican lawmakers want to take this step of making this a constitutional amendment?
So a constitutional amendment goes through a different process than a typical law. It has to pass in two consecutive legislative sessions, and then it also has to be approved by voters in an election. That means that it bypasses a governor's veto authority. So notably, as you mentioned, there has been other legislation similar to this. In 2021, there was a bill that passed in the legislature that would have prevented church closures in response to COVID-19 specifically. Governor Tony Evers vetoed that. And so this would get around that veto power. When I spoke to the co-authors of this proposal, they say it's, you know, it's really just a way of tightening up religious freedom laws in Wisconsin. Critics of the proposal say that religious freedom law is already very strong, and they sort of point to bypassing that veto authority as perhaps the reasoning for doing it.
So it must pass in two consecutive legislative sessions and then get approved through a statewide referendum in order to take effect, in order to change that piece of the Constitution. So right now, where is this legislation at exactly?
It's in very, very early days. It just went through a public hearing process in committee. And okay. And then it got voted out of committee. And so it's unclear whether it will be taken up by the legislature when they reconvene this fall. So this would be the first legislative session that it could be considered under. It would then need to go through again next year if it did pass this year. And so it wouldn't go before voters at the earliest until 2025.
We're talking about church exemptions to government orders with Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR State Capitol reporter. You can join in along the way with your questions questions and your comments pertaining to this joint resolution exempting churches from government-imposed restrictions. The number is 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, where does this issue sit in terms of separation of church and state?
Yeah, so the bill's authors say that this is kind of the definition of separation of church and state, that the government simply can't tell a house of worship what to do in any form, whether to be open or whether to be closed. According to the authors, 9 other states have passed similar laws. And so it appears that this type of language or legislation has passed, you know, constitutional scrutiny. As I mentioned, critics of the proposal say that Wisconsin already has a very strong religious freedom law in its constitution. Some people say it's actually stronger than the First Amendment of the federal constitution. And so they say that this is just kind of a politicized response to how the COVID-19 emergency was handled. And I will say also, you know, I've spoken with public health officials and they're concerned that this would limit their ability to take action for potential future pandemics.
Would this open the door to other types of organizations that would want similar measures?
That's a great question. You know, I think religious institutions are protected in a way that, for example, businesses or schools aren't necessarily, because there is that constitutional protection of religious freedom and religious rights. And so it's unclear whether they would have the type of authority that houses of worship have. But it is possible, you know, once you kind of start limiting how public health officials can respond to public health emergencies, you know, can you continue legislating kind of on down the line around those types of closures that really were so controversial all through the COVID-19 pandemic?
And then along those lines, do you think that Republican lawmakers will pursue more constitutional amendments this way when they repeatedly see Governor Evers vetoing their legislation that they pass onto his desk?
Constitutional amendments, they are complicated, as we discussed, that they just take quite a long time. So this is one way to get around veto authority. One of the bill's co-authors said to me, though, that this is not a response to Governor Evers specifically. He pointed out that some Republican governors also, you know, imposed extraordinary measures during the COVID-19 pandemic. And he just disagrees with all of those, you know, categorically, whether it's a Democratic or a Republican governor who did it. So there is a way that this amendment process can be used to get legislation through that we know that Governor Evers would not support. But it's not super straightforward, because again, it does take 2+ years. And, you know, we have an election coming up next year. Things could be kind of changing in terms of who's in the legislature. So there's never a guarantee that this will get a lawmaker the outcome that they want.
Reminds me of a Wisconsin dance studio that was sued for allegedly holding a performance for an audience of 119 people in December of 2020. And the performance violated the emergency order prohibiting mass gatherings at the time. It was recently dropped, the suit. Would the proposed amendment exempt churches from this type of litigation?
Yeah, so in theory, houses of worship would just be exempt from any emergency orders like that on the local, state, or federal level. And so that lawsuit just sort of would be moot, you know, on its face to start with, mm-hmm. in theory, according to the language of this proposed amendment.
Anya, let's shift now to the legislature this fall, what you have your eye on, what you'll be covering, where we are in the legislative session. Can you kind of give us a preview?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because over summer, lawmakers can just start to propose, you know, any number of kind of personal interests. And so I'm really interested in this. I think that constitutional amendments, as you mentioned, are an interesting kind of tool. And so we'll definitely be paying attention to this. There have also been some interesting proposals this summer around social media use and, you know, kind of how AI is used. And so there's kind of these, you know, we were paying so much attention to very local issues over the course of the spring and the budget process. And so it's kind of interesting to see what lawmakers are taking up over a kind of slow summer and prioritizing for the fall.
Do you think things will, be a little bit more active in the fall? Do you anticipate it will be, a busy fall for the legislature?
Oh, certainly. I think also, you know, we're obviously going into an election year. And so there's going to be, I think, a lot of conversation around our election laws and kind of getting ready for what will be a critical election cycle. Obviously, Wisconsin is always at the crux of these national elections. And so I think seeing how lawmakers start to approach voting process and election laws will be sort of front of mind for me as well.
Anya, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter, and it's part of our State Capitol Report, which you hear every Monday. You can go to our program page to find more conversations, more from the State Capitol Report. Visit WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Legislation called the CARE Act ensures hospitals don't discharge patients without preparing family caregivers for medical tasks that they will have to do for the patient at home. According to the National Library of Medicine, the act was passed in 40 states. Advocates want Wisconsin to follow suit. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bryn Seaman is an Older Americans Act consultant and family caregiver support specialist at the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources, Inc. Bryn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. And Janet Zander is here, Advocacy and Public Policy Coordinator at the agency. Janet, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Kate. Great to be here.
Janet, let's start with you. The CARE Act stands for Caregiver Advise, Record, Enable. Without this law here in Wisconsin, how do family caregivers know what assistance their loved ones need when they leave a hospital?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people get written discharge plans and people try to interpret those. Some receive excellent discharge planning from their hospital. Others receive less than the best opportunity to be successful. And so they're relying on what they know, what family members might know. But at the end of the day, they're less prepared and less confident to provide what their caregivers are going to need, which means keeping them free from pain and avoiding complications that ultimately could lead to readmission to the hospital.
What are the complications of hospital discharge planning? Where might communication break down?
There's a number of areas. First, in the discharge planning itself, when is someone going to be discharged? How will they get home? What care equipment will they need? Have their medications changed? And most importantly, I think, is what care will the caregiver be responsible for providing? And do they know how to do that? You know, and we're talking about complex care, managing multiple medications, providing wound care, managing special diets. Sometimes there's injectables or other specialized equipment. So it's not just the things we intuitively would know how to do.
Bryn, looking at this nationwide shortage of paid in-home caregiving aides resulted in more people relying on day-to-day assistance from family members. What support is there for family caregivers who may not be able to find a paid professional to provide, you know, more specialized care?
I think more and more family caregivers are having to look inward, expand their informal support. So those are those 580,000 family caregivers and friends who currently provide about $9.2 billion of unpaid care. So creating their own support system. We do have wonderful allies and partners that also offer respite care through the Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. So there are some alternatives, but the lack of professional caregivers absolutely impacts the family and impacts the person receiving the care when they're discharged from the hospital.
I wonder how you feel about the state's efforts to approach this with the WISC Caregiver Careers Program, increasing direct care, you know, workforce. I'm wondering, will a free program to train up more nursing assistants help solve this workforce challenge?
Well, I sure hope so. I mean, it certainly couldn't hurt. I think it's a wonderful initiative. It's an opportunity to provide free training. It's an opportunity to potentially receive a bonus. If it's a passion and a career of yours, we need more carers, professional carers, in order to meet the ever-growing demand.
How much of demand do you see that is unfilled, unmet right now, and family is trying to pitch in to resolve?
I think it varies. It varies a lot on the type of care needs. It varies on the location throughout the state. Rural versus more urban or suburban areas are going to have a different need. Right now, again, using that same number, $9.2 billion of care that's provided that's unpaid for would suggest that we have quite the unfilled positions or the unfilled need of professional carers. And I think that the opportunity to train and facilitate education for professional carers should be both offered through DHS as it is currently, but also we see smaller respite and smaller communities popping up to really invoke the small community, the family caregiver, and so that they're more competent and able to provide the care that they need to as well.
Bryn Seaman, their Older Americans Act consultant. Janet Zander with us, advocacy coordinator at the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. As we look at the complexities of family caregiving, you can join in the conversation with your questions, your experiences. They're welcome here at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Janet, in 2019, the CARE Act was introduced in the state legislature. It did not receive a committee hearing, and the bill doesn't currently have a sponsor. Why do you think lawmakers could consider the model legislation this session?
I think there's a number of things happening right now that make it an opportune time. One is, as you mentioned, over 40 states have gone before us. That means we have an opportunity to learn from those states. So for our family caregivers, for our aging and disability resource centers who help to support them, as well as for our legislators and our hospitals across the state, we have folks that we can turn to who've tried this, who know what works, who knows what doesn't work. So I think that's helpful. I also think that this time around, we see a lot of things happening at the federal level with the introduction of a national strategy to support family caregivers. There's an incredible amount of resources available to us for those states that have not yet passed the CARE Act. And we have a proposal within Medicare to support a payment code for healthcare providers who are helping to train family caregivers. And I think all those things aligned might make us more successful this time.
Could the federal law restricting the release of medical information, is that interfering with the objective of this legislation?
I don't believe so. It's been very successfully implemented in other states. It really relies on a strong electronic health record. And this is all driven by the patient themselves. Patients identify if they have a family caregiver and then ask them to be placed on the chart. So there's not a confidentiality or HIPAA violation as long as patients are the ones making those decisions.
Bryn mentioned 580,000 family caregivers in Wisconsin providing over $9 billion in unpaid care. How could the CARE Act help healthcare systems see caregivers as more essential partners in patient care?
One of the things that has been identified in the states that have already implemented the CARE Act is that they often thought they were talking to the caregiver because they were talking to a family member or a power of attorney for healthcare, some sort of next of kin person. But in fact, that person turned out to not always be the one providing the primary care that's needed. And so I think really The CARE Act hones in on who is the person that you feel is going to be providing the most care, and then what do we want them to know? And we know it's certainly in hospitals' best interest not to see unnecessary readmissions. And we still know that 80% of the care is being provided by these folks at home, and that 65% of our older adults with long-term care needs depend exclusively on family and friends. And so in the light of this workforce shortage, I think hospitals are recognizing the increasing importance of having well-trained family and informal caregivers.
Janet Zander is Advocacy and Public Policy Coordinator at Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. Bryn Seaman with us, a family caregiver support specialist with the agency. As we discuss caregiving, call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine challenges of family caregivers and new policies to support them. Governor Tony Evers' Task Force on Caregiving in its 2020 report estimates there are 580,000 family caregivers providing hundreds of millions of hours of unpaid care annually. Call in with a question, share your experience in caregiving, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Janet Zander, Advocacy and Public Policy Coordinator, and Bryn Seaman, an Older Americans Act consultant, both from Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. Bryn, you this year surveyed caregivers throughout the state about their hospital discharge experiences. What did they tell you about how prepared they were to take care of people heading home from a hospital?
We surveyed statewide for approximately 5 months family caregivers, and we narrowed down the respondents to those who had a hospital discharge experience of a loved one within the past 3 years, just so we could really get an idea of what the current state of affairs are. From them, what we heard is there's certainly positives, as Janet said, it's not all bad. We also heard, though, that there are definitely areas of improvement and a desire to feel more like allies in the process of discharge planning. They want to be that partner. Of those that responded, 42% said that they really felt very uncomfortable in completing the caregiving tasks that immediately followed the hospital discharge.
42% very uncomfortable. And I'm also thinking about the stress of having a loved one in the hospital going through an ordeal, and then now the additional stress of having to continue care at home. Did they respond a little bit at all about that, about managing the stressful circumstances?
They did. Yeah, we asked specifically about the training that they received from hospital staff. Now, keep in mind, we really did keep it open. So this could be from the doctor, from the nurse, from the social work discharge planner, about the training or different instruction that they might need post-hospitalization. And 76% reported no, that they did not receive any training as a family caregiver from those hospital staff. So that's quite a number, and that's an area of opportunity that we could improve. We also probed a little further and asked about community resources. Were you given information about local aging and disability resource center, local human services, adult protective services? All of these are preventative opportunities, hoping that the patient wouldn't have to be readmitted if a family caregiver needed assistance. And once again, the same 76% also reported that no, they were not provided with any of this community contact information.
In the survey, more than 8 in 10 family caregivers in Wisconsin reported work interruptions. Janet, caregivers reported having to quit a job or reduce work hours. How significantly are the demands of family caregiving impacting our state's economy?
impacting more and more. We know that 60% of our family caregivers are working full or part-time, but as our workforce shortage remains in a crisis state, we see family caregivers stepping in more and more and more, and that means stepping out of the workplace. And we have many, many unfilled jobs across all of the fields in Wisconsin and even and across the nation, but we need those folks to be able to stay employed for their own financial security, their retirement security. Having folks trying to do all of this at one time is just a recipe for disaster.
Bryn, what resources are there for workers trying to balance their jobs and caregiving responsibilities?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. It's very much an initiative of an alliance that I'm a part of, the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance. We have a website, of course we do, wisconsincaregiver.org. Again, all one word, wisconsincaregiver.org. On the resources tab of that page, we actually do have some information about family caregivers who are working and conversations they can have with their direct supervisor, resources that might be able to be tapped in. Sometimes there's actually employment resources that employees just don't know about. We also have a wonderful free e-learning platform in the state of Wisconsin called Truelta. And they have wonderful caregiver supports on ideas for balancing work and caregiving. And again, that can include so many things. It could be a job share opportunity, flexible or remote work. It could just be sabbatical, short leaves, making sure that you're still retaining that institutional knowledge and that employee, even if they might need a short temporary break to care for a loved one.
Bryn, can you offer some tips for caregivers at hospital discharge, things that we can think about or actively do at this point?
Sure. I think that we all have heard the expression, an additional set of ears, an additional set of eyes is helpful. And I think when the patient at doctor's appointments are willing to let family come in, that's acceptable. The physician and the medical doctor are more than willing to talk to the family caregiver. I think the same too could be said for a discharge experience. Families sometimes are tentative. You don't want to overstep and you recognize there's a hospital policy and procedure, but I think it is absolutely okay to ask to be named in the chart as a person who's going to be providing that care when your loved one is released. It's also okay to ask if you can talk with a discharge planner. Again, that might be the physician doing rounds in the morning. That might be a nurse. That might be a social work discharge planner. But explaining the role that you're going to have is going to be vital so that the training and the resources provided could absolutely provided to the patient, but also include you. That makes you feel more confident. That allows you to provide the care in a quality way. We also want to think about caregivers as a potential future patient. If a caregiver isn't taking care of themselves or gets hurt during a transfer, now you have two people that we're potentially caring for in a health system. So making sure we're preserving that family caregiver and that we're asking the right questions so that we can take care of ourselves as well as take care of the patient following discharge.
Bryn Seaman there and Janet Zander, as we talk about family caregiving, both from the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. You can join in the conversation with your question at 800-642-1234. Janet, what other legislation and policies is the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources focusing on beyond the CARES Act?
Certainly have a number of caregiver priorities. A state tax credit for our family caregivers has been on our agenda for the last couple of legislative sessions, recognizing that not only are these caregivers having to leave the workforce and providing more care, but they're spending a lot of money out of their own pockets to help meet their loved ones' care needs. So, you know, in excess of $7,000 a year. So a caregiver tax credit at any amount will start to ease some of that financial burden on family caregivers. As Bryn mentioned, respite is a critical resource, so we are seeking in additional funding for respite service grants so that our caregivers can take care of their own health and well-being. We also have In the last budget, we were able to get some additional funding for the Alzheimer's Family and Caregiver Support Program, which does provide some respite and support services for those caring for someone with dementia. And we're looking for some additional flexibilities in that program, really updating it from its initiation to where we are today in terms of the cap that's provided on goods and services and who can be providing those services, et cetera. So we've got a wealth of priorities just in the caregiving arena.
And also not mentioned here, but you want to fund minimum provider reimbursement rates for home and community-based services, in a program to really help agencies recruit qualified workers, reduce turnover. What do you envision there?
We recognize that paid supports are often complementary to family caregiving, and we're hoping that we can increase that workforce by really making those living wages, by offering the payment rates enough to pay those wages at a higher rate is going to help us bring more workers in. And so we just have to recognize the value of this workforce, which has traditionally been devalued as domestic workers and not really thought about as also healthcare partners. And so lifting those up really will bring more people back into the workforce, especially if we can also address other important benefits like health insurance and paid leave and those kinds of things.
Going back to the first item on your list, supporting this tax credit for family caregivers, Governor Evers included the tax credit in his proposed budget. It was taken out during the budget process. Why should lawmakers consider a tax credit for caregivers?
I think what we have been communicating with them is really that because these caregivers are leaving the workforce, we're decreasing their income and increasing their cost. We need to recognize that a caregiver tax credit, A, is going to keep some of those caregivers able to provide support, and meaning they can continue to contribute to our economy, and B, those caregivers are way cheaper to provide than having to rely on all paid supports. And so we need to incentivize those folks and reward those folks for the kind of work that they're doing. And we hear a lot, family caregivers, this is what they should be expected to do. And certainly many, many, many people step in voluntarily. Sometimes they're the last one available. And so that's not always can be a challenge. But we're asking way more of them now that we're looking at really complex care that many folks are providing. I think the more ways we can support them, the more ways that they will continue to be able to provide that essential service.
We only have a few moments left, but we did hear from Eric in Brown County and said, you know, people spend a lot of money during the last few weeks of a person's life. Could that money be better spent? Is there a better way to manage resources? Janet, do you have, in a few moments left, any reaction to that?
We do know that a lot of the money is spent in the last days of somebody's life. And I don't know what, you know, we rely heavily on hospice and palliative care and all the other supports that are critically important to making sure somebody has quality of life right up until the end of life. So I just think knowing that many people want to remain in their own home for as long as possible with the support of those family members, that's going to keep our costs down.
Thank you both for joining us. Janet Zander, Advocacy and Public Policy Coordinator at Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. Bryn Seaman is an Older Americans Act consultant and family caregiver support specialist with the agency. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.